Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus. Have accessed entry 692.JU0113, certificate number 31644, Cahotec.
I hope that this combat give us some information, perhaps many information about, perhaps in the explanation of the questions concerning the evolution and origin of the solar system, and in that case would be, I hope, very important for mankind also.
You know, an interesting thing about assembling these recordings is that not only do we not know who we may be talking to, or indeed if we're being heard at all, but we don't know when. We have no idea of the time frame at which you, whoever you are hearing our voices. Like, it's not clear whether, you know, the people listening to this are listening 40 years from now after some very immediate radioactive calamity.
Right.
Or if this is literally a million years hence and there's been like all kinds of heating and cooling cycles and finally the glaciers have melted, revealing the massive granite mountain where all this has been carved, you know.
Right. But somewhere ages and ages hence.
Sure. But it would be nice to think that someone in the year 77,000, more or less, is listening to this.
77,000 by our reckoning.
By our current reckoning. Common era, as you say, if you're a new atheist. Mm-hmm. That someone is listening to this because it will be very relevant. The period of the comet we call Cahotec is thought to be about 75,000 years.
So Cahotec is a comet that has visited Earth.
Yes.
And you're suggesting that maybe this podcast will help them the next time the comet comes around.
It will come back in around 77,000 years.
Okay.
Or 75,000 years from now, from the day we're speaking. And it will be very timely then. You know, I hope we're just in time for that news hit.
I remember I was a child when the comet Cahotec came the first time. And I remember that was back when there were only three television stations. So when a comet came, it was really in the newspapers. It was a big deal.
It was a huge deal at the time. Which is more interesting than the comet itself is the kind of furor it caused in society. In March 1973, when young John Roderick was
5 years old.
5 years old, a Czech scientist named Luboš Cahotec. You're going to like this. There's a Central European hook.
Yeah, Luboš Cahotec.
You're into this already.
You know, Cahotec sounds like an Aztec or a Mayan name.
Sure,
right?
the Cahotecs. Mysterious, yeah. Mysterious death of the Cahotecs, leaving their stone ziggurats in the jungle.
They disappeared after Pizarro landed. But Cahotec is actually a Czech name in this.
Cahotec is not a Guatemalan ruin. It's a nice Czech man who is working at an observatory in Hamburg, West Germany. And while he's looking at plates of something, another discovery that he's more interested in, an asteroid, he sees a dot he can't explain and realizes he has discovered.
Who hasn't, right? I mean, you reach a certain age.
Ask, yeah. Please consult the dermatologist if you see a Cahotec on you right now. But he believes he's discovered a new comet. It was not there before. And notifies the scientific community. And suddenly, the world is abuzz with the idea, for some reason, of this little dot that he's seen on a piece of paper.
It's not just the scientific and astronomic community that's abuzz, but it it percolates out into the world of lay people.
It starts with scientists, and then you get the pop science pieces in Newsweek and in the New York Times.
Right, back when people read those magazines.
Yeah, we should probably explain.
Listen, there was a time when Newsweek and Time magazine were in competition with one another, like Coke and Pepsi. Time was always the Coke. Newsweek was always
Newsweek
the Pepsi.
Newsweek is the off-brand one. And U.S. News and World Report is like RC Cola. Like, it's a little bit suspect.
And that came later, too. I never knew anybody that had that except a dentist's office.
You think that's some kind of weird USA Today late period arrival?
Yeah. But I feel like Time magazine was the edifice, and Newsweek seemed a little bit more rock and roll.
Sure, because you can imagine Time with, like, Churchill on the cover. Yeah. You know, Time goes back to the 20s.
Yeah.
And Newsweek is definitely, you know, the sketchy off-brand one.
Well, it's right in the title, like Time or Newsweek.
Right.
It's not the same.
It's almost like it should have the capital W, you know, in the middle of the word.
Yeah.
And the logos back then, the Time had the very stentorian red thing that you know, it was like some font you'd see on the Lincoln Memorial. And Newsweek was this chunky thing with these massive square serifs.
Yeah.
That really looked like some me generation piece of crap. You
Hashtag
know?
Newsweek. but very definitely at the time, if Time magazine wrote a pop science article about a comet, you could be assured that 100 million people would, at the end of that week, be aware of it.
This is something we're explaining, not just to people 77,000 years from now. This is something we're explaining to people 7 months from now. There used to be print magazines. You're not going to believe it.
And everybody read them.
Those little subscription cards were everywhere. They just flew around like snow.
It was like Neil deGrasse Tyson saying something about, you know, about this comet, but it wouldn't have the same reach as Time.
No, and Kohoutek was on the cover of Time magazine.
Wow.
And at the end of 1973, there's a big Time cover package on the Fords, newly in the White House, or not in the White House, newly Vice President Ford.
Mm-hmm.
That is right?
Yeah, he would have become president shortly thereafter, but he was
the following spring.
Spiro Agnew had just resigned the vice presidency because he was under indictment for tax fraud, and Ford was our new vice president.
So there's a cover package on Gerald and Betty Ford, and in the lower left, there is a inset saying special comet section, you know, like that's the big draw. A comet that no one has seen, a faint blur on some Czechoslovakian guy's astronomical plate. And yet people start going crazy over it.
Because why? Because it's being hyped as what?
It's going to be big. Whatever science that... So these comets come from the Oort cloud, which lies out beyond the orbit of Neptune. You know, the solar system is a big plane. It's essentially a flat disk. The planets all orbiting around the sun in the same plane. But not the Oort cloud. The Oort cloud's a big sphere of big chunks of ice and dust out way far beyond, farther than we've ever sent any probe, but still technically part of the solar system in a sense.
Yeah.
And
this is the Oort cloud between the solar system and Uranus?
Uranus, we should probably say to avoid kind
is
of.
Is that right? Is that the commonplace or the accepted nomenclature? Uranus?
No, I think it's overcorrecting by ninth grade science teachers who are tired
Uranus.
Of the jokes.
I mean, that has the word urine in it. It's no better than Uranus.
You're right. It's worse. It sounds like an adjective describing urine.
Yeah. I think we can say Uranus without giggling, although we weren't able to.
I think we could talk about Uranus all day without giggling.
See?
Everyone loves Uranus.
See, there you go.
It's out beyond the orbit of it's, you know, it's trans-Neptunian. It's farther than the furthest planet.
Okay.
But it's still technically part of the solar system because it's attracted by the gravity of the sun.
So is this maybe where the Millennium Falcon went into a meteor and there was that giant worm inside?
John, I shouldn't have to explain this to you. The Star Wars is a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away.
Oh, right.
Far,
right.
far away, okay. Not just elsewhere in
I'm
our
sorry.
Solar system.
I'm sorry, you're right. Okay, so it came from the Oort cloud, which is actually the name of my autobiography.
It came from the Oort cloud. Occasionally, the Oort cloud is perturbed by gravity, you know, nearby stars. I think the pull of the Milky Way itself creates a tide, which can disrupt stuff.
Huh.
And stuff can start getting pulled in to an orbit in the inner planets. And that's when, occasionally, we see a comet here on Earth.
Yeah, it gets dislodged. And then all of a sudden is on a collision course with the center of our solar system.
Sure, it's heading in towards the inner planets. And historically, people have not been into this. Comets are, in history, are omens of doom.
Harbingers of bad times.
They're harbingers. Yeah, and maybe that's true in your time as well, futurelings. I don't know what kind of superstitions you have about comets.
Right.
But in human history, you know, a comet was linked with the Black Death, I think Halley's Comet arrived the same year the temple in Jerusalem fell in 70 AD, mm-hmm. the Black Death, the Norman Conquest.
Coincided with Halley's Comet?
Yeah, you can see Halley's Comet. It's in the bio tapestry that's been, the famous embroidered version of the Battle of Hastings. Halley's Comet is up there. Like, they saw that as an important sign of the defeat because comets were thought of as bad news. The historian Nicetas referred to Halley's Comet at one point as a twisting serpent whose gaping mouth lusts for human blood.
Hmm.
Which seems a little speculative. It's
A
small white hyphen in the sky, and this guy insists upon seeing a twisting serpent lusting for blood.
So in the Middle Ages, there had been considerable astronomical advance, but that wasn't really disseminated among the sort of normals.
And nobody would have had the tools to know what these things were.
Right.
You know, they're just wandering stars. They come and they don't do the things we expect and they go.
But in 1973/4, we had a lot more power to observe outer space and to have a sense of what these things were. So why were we so agitated about it?
This was sort of the opposite. I don't think we were afraid of it. People were very, very excited. And I think there was some scientific reason for that. It was heading towards the sun when we first spotted it, which means, by the way, that nobody could see the tail.
Because it was obscured behind the face.
Right. People imagine the tail of a comet, maybe follows out behind it because we're accustomed to the idea that it flies like a rocket.
Right, like a contrail.
Right.
But it actually is it's opposite the direction where the sun is shooting at it.
That is correct. Yeah. Yes. Like the direction of a comet's tail has nothing to do with its motion. It could be perpendicular to the axis of travel. It could actually be coming ahead of the comet, as it were, because the tail is not formed by the motion of the comet. It's the solar wind coming from the sun with ionized gases, blowing and melting stuff off the head of the comet, which is just a lump of dust and ice, frozen gases.
So all we could see is just a light dot
we see
approaching,
a dot.
But we know it's going to put on a show.
Right. And apparently there's ways to measure just how fast it's burning off ammonia and methane or whatnot. And it's going to be good. It's burning up a lot of stuff. And so the scientific community starts making announcements to the people about what a spectacle this is going to be in December and January when it finally shows up. It's going to be so bright you can see it in the daytime, possibly. The tail is going to measure fully 1/6 of the sky.
So this is what I remember from being a kid. People talking about this thing coming, and it was going to light up the night.
It's going to knock our socks off. There were actually warnings, you're going to want to look at it in the day, but watch out because the sun's very bright. We don't want anybody hurting their retinas looking at Comet Kohoutek. And I think part of it was that it was new and unexpected. Like, just by freak chance, it had been discovered right before it was heading to us. So suddenly it's like, there's a new comet that nobody's known about. Halley's Comet it's on a cycle, 76 right. years. It's like cicadas. We expect it. This is some new guy, 6 months after it's discovered, it's going to be here for the first time. So there's some sense of novelty and adventure.
Well, and to put it in context, right, this was the peak era of our fascination with space. We were still going to the moon at this point in time.
Right. It was right at the end of the Apollo program.
But that was just the culmination of really a span of only 15 years that we had been actively pursuing space flight and exploration. Skylab was in the sky?
Skylabs 1 and 2 had already launched. And at the time that Kohoutek was first spotted, Skylab 3 was being prepped. And I think NASA, sort of sensing an ebbing of public interest in space, sees a sexy new mascot and says, guess what? Skylab 3 is going to be all about Kohoutek, your favorite kids. So NASA rebrands Skylab 3 as doing all kinds of comet studying stuff. And everyone's very excited. We're going to put some people in orbit. Skylab, an orbiting scientific space station, the first of its of kind, at least American.
Right.
And everyone's very excited that NASA's going to put three guys in space just to look at Kohoutek, our new friend from beyond the stars.
The tail we have found, as it becomes more foreshortened to us, became much wider. And let me give you figures that are relative to the display we have on the ATM. I would say that the bright coma was approximately 1/8 to 3/16 of an inch in diameter. And I would say that the tail that we could see, however foreshortened, extended only about 1/4 inch away from the coma and spread like a fan to approximately 3/8 inch at its outermost end.
Wow. So this, it really was like a perfect storm of interest in looking up at the sky.
And so science profits, you know, people in science and astronomy to this day are forever overhyping things in the hopes of getting
funding,
people interested in, yeah, in getting their projects funded. And it's a double-edged sword, you know?
Like, right, because there's some super expectation of it.
Have you noticed this thing now where on social media, people will overhype, tonight the moon is going to be, you know, 8% bigger than usual, or, you know, this is the first time Venus has been this close to Mars since last April, you know, and everyone's got to go outside and look at these very, very minor celestial happenings.
Well, and that, in my experience, has been true of almost every big meteor shower, the Perseids. Even when Halley's Comet was here, it was an experience where you went out, looked up, saw a smudge, and, you know, kind of did a Clark Griswold of like, 1, 2, 3. Okay, kids, let's go back in the house. Other than the northern lights, I really have never seen an astronomical experience that truly blew me away, including eclipses both of the sun and moon.
You've seen a total solar eclipse?
I was in a totality one time in Romania, and at the last second, a cloud came across the face of the sun.
Oh, man.
The sky grew dark. The animals all went and put themselves to bed. There was that weird vibrating super light.
But you were in the one pasture that had a cloud.
I was standing there
you.
With my little paper glasses in a farmyard with a little Romanian family looking up. And then the totality passed. And then the cloud passed. And we just looked at each other like, well, that was really, I mean, it was still amazing, but our opportunity to see something truly groovy was.
So we're in this jaded post-Vietnam, post-Watergate generation where even the heavens disappoint us, I guess. And Kotek is actually the beginning of that story of people being let down by everything. William Sapphire in the New York Times wrote, as Kotek was approaching, in a future age when the names of Nixon and Brezhnev are dimly remembered, and those of Irvin and Mitchell and Dean are minor footnotes in scholarly treatises, those future links, those are Watergate conspirators.
Watergate conspirators.
I guess Irvin is an investigator.
You can be forgiven for not knowing who they are, although you should know who Nixon and Brezhnev are.
Luckily, John and I do not live in a time when we have to know the names of the president's weaselly venal corrupt friends. That's not a problem anymore. So, 1973 only.
Some of us do just because we have a lot of time on our hands.
Sapphire says, even when Nixon and Brezhnev and all these people are forgotten, the name and discovery that will illuminate the year 1973 will be Lubos Kohotek.
Isn't that astonishing?
He predicted that, you know, there'd be boulevards named for Lubos Kohotek.
I don't want to jump ahead, but this feels very familiar. This sort of overhyping of a thing that's going to be remembered forever, and then it turns out to be like a little bit of a dud.
Yeah, as a species, we're terrible at knowing what persists, right?
Yeah, we're constantly saying, like, this is going to be the one for the ages. And I'm having a hard time even remembering examples of what I'm trying to describe.
There's a trial of the century every 6 months now.
Right.
They can't all be the trial of the century. I've had the experience of looking back at bestsellers from the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s. They are not the classics that are read today. All these things sold 10 million copies and nobody cares at all. Luckily, you and I have this project to finally make an authoritative and correct listing of what need be remembered.
Right. And I feel like in the annals of early 21st century podcasts, this is going to be the one that stands in for the whole genre.
Sure. This will be the one in your textbook.
Yeah.
You know?
Right now, the shows that are popular, like Marc Maron and what's that ding-a-ling from the old, he was like on a TV show with,
Chris Hardwick.
No, he's not a ding-a-ling. No, the guy, what am I trying to say? He was like the second banana on a TV show where they had girls in bikinis bouncing on trampolines.
Adam Carolla,
thank you. He's a very popular podcaster now.
But you're saying he will not be anthologized.
Futurelings aren't going to remember him. He's going to be like the pulp novelist of the
1920s.
But we'll be like To Kill a Mockingbird or Moby Dick. Raven. We're the thing that every kid has to read.
That's right.
But kids always hate the thing they have to read.
Well, that's right too. Yeah.
Kids will hate us, and then they'll discover Adam Carolla and be like, hey, check this out. He'll be like Kerouac to them.
Yeah, right.
He'll be like Catcher in the Rye.
So this was like a big deal, 1974. They're going to name boulevards after Quixote.
Yeah, everyone in late 1973 is convinced this is going to be the biggest thing. The QE2 sets sail for cruises in the North Atlantic for comet observation with a record 1,673 people aboard.
Oof.
Dr. Quixote himself is invited, although he gets jet lag and spends most of the trip sick in his cabin. And Isaac Asimov, science fiction writer who is a bit of a gadabout, raconteur, bon vivant type.
Likes going to parties.
He gets in front of everybody and ad-libs about what comet Asimov would be like.
I know from personal experience as a rock and roller that no small number of rock albums of the era were named after Quixote.
Let's talk about that. What do you got?
So there was... Sun Ra had a concert, the concert for Quixote.
Was this a benefit? Is this like the concert for Bangladesh? Children are dying in Quixote.
Space is the place. Space is the place. Yes, space is the place. Outer space.
I think that probably Sun Ra took the cash.
I think Sun Ra probably believed Quixote was an actual alien planet that he was doing a benefit for.
I bet he thought that they were going to go live on it. The first ever single of Kraftwerk.
Yes, Kraftwerk's first single.
Quixote. Or Quixote Kometen Melody.
As the fans call it. Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Argent.
The Zombies side project, right?
That's right. They had three tracks, which were like a song cycle. A suite of music inspired by Quixote. The songs were The Coming of Quixote, and then Once Around the Sun, and then concluding with Infinite Wanderer.
We should talk about like how Rocket this time loved space so much. The first Hawkwind concert in America, famed British space rock supergroup Hawkwind, was actually held at the Hayden Planetarium at this time.
Really?
Because of course it was.
Of course.
And their opener was some long-haired scientist who tried to dazzle the crowd with predictions of what Comet Quixote was going to do.
Really?
Yes. And the crowd was insanely bored and started yelling, Hawkwind! as this poor guy tried to talk about Quixote.
Well, it wasn't just the sort of avant-garde. It was also Journey had had an instrumental song, Quixote, on their debut record. So even big stadium rockers Journey got involved.
That's how you know it's reached the people. When Quixote hits Journey.
That's right. One other thing. Pink Floyd.
Of course.
Had a live record, which was a bootleg, but still a live record called In Celebration of the Comet, The Coming of Quixote. And it was where they debuted The Dark Side of the Moon.
Wow.
At their live show, The Coming of Quixote.
Now, John, you're a extremely popular, beloved musician in our era. Can you explain the early 70s fascination with space among high rockers?
I've thought about this a lot over time, not just among rockers, but like culturally. Because I was a little kid during this period, and space and the idea that we were that this was an inevitable progression, right? From Kennedy's exclamation in the very early 60s that we were going to put a man on the moon by the end of the 60s to the time I was born in 68, just prior to...
To the great step for mankind.
To the great step for mankind. So I actually am an artifact from a long ago time before we had walked on the moon. But it seemed that we had made all this progress in 10 years and that that same pace of exploration was going to continue unabated.
That was the new timescale of humanity.
This was it. We had gone from being astonished that we could put people on the moon to doing it sort of as a matter of course. Like how many Americans have walked on the surface of the moon? Do you know?
Yeah, just 12.
12.
Would have been 14 if Apollo 13 had had, you know, better oxygen tanks or something.
But still, 12 is an awful lot of people to have accomplished that journey, which was, I mean, technologically like unimaginably complicated.
And it really did create the idea that America could just do anything if it just put its mind to it. You
right.
know, a few years later, oh yeah, the moon, sure.
Sure, we're going to go stand on the moon. And then, although the space shuttle was like a garbage compromise of all the great ideas that had been put forth as our next thing, like it, well, there were all these fantastic space planes in development, and we ended up with this school bus space shuttle because of political pressure. And because obviously, like, the space program is an enormous expense, and we could be spending that money on army cars,
sure.
army cars and army guns.
You could get a fighter and a half for what the space shuttle costs.
But at the time, particularly like in the, I mean, in the arts, but across the spectrum of like our cultural world in the early 70s, when we had real social unrest in the country, right? Like the election in 1972, George Wallace ran on an openly white supremacist ticket. There were riots in all of the major cities. People were abandoning the urban core. New York City was becoming like a crime-ridden and uninhabitable...
bombed-out hellhole.
Yeah, we didn't...
As it probably is in your day, listener. Sorry, no offense.
So it seemed like we were losing control of the earth. Things were terrible here. And there was this utopian possibility in space. And of course, like, space rockers or progressive rockers also had aspirations to be intellectuals. And so I think all of those song suites that we're describing, I think now when we think of the future, we think of a sort of dystopian, Blade Runner-y kind of
sure.
future where cockroaches are sentient and listening to podcasts.
No offense, guys.
But at the time, it seemed like we were going to create a space civilization and leave behind our decrepit planet.
Like within a decade, we could be in the gleaming space city of a Yes album cover.
Right.
Like when people looked at prog covers, they were really thinking, maybe that's my first apartment.
I mean, think about the cover of Boston's first album, where a city
sure.
under a dome is on top of a guitar, which is also a spaceship.
So many kids saw that and thought, that's for me.
Like
that was actually a real estate aspiration for them.
Yeah.
Well, it wasn't just music. Yeah, Pinnacle Books sold 750,000 copies of a Kohoutek themed quickie paperback with, you know, holiday recipes and thoughts about Kohoutek, I guess. Planetariums are getting thousands of calls a day to their celestial update line.
This is all before Kohoutek has arrived.
Kohoutek has not even appeared yet. Nobody can wait.
Wow.
And but the promise has been that it'll be at its closest right around Christmas, December 28th. And then in January, there's going to be some dark skies and it's going to be perfect. And it becomes very clear by December that this is not panning out. Because Kohoutek is a first-time comet, you know, making its first appearance. It's a long-period comet. It's not Halley's Comet. It's not a shuttle bus. It's not a local. It's making its first appearance in our space in tens of thousands of years. It had a lot to burn off. And it burned off very quickly. And by the time it passed the sun and came out the other side, there was just not much going on anymore.
So if you'd been watching Kohoutek from the other side of the sun, it might have been quite a show.
Yes. If there's some parallel counter-Earth with bizarro analogs of all of us that is exactly opposite the sun from us right now, they probably have the Kohoutek-based lifestyle that William Sapphire envisioned. But we do not. Here, Kohoutek is a buzzword for fizzle and disappointment because all the cruises were terrible. People aboard the QE2, you know, they tried to keep up a party attitude and, you know, they were told that even if we don't see the comet, it's still all about the camaraderie. This is an adventure much like Woodstock, to which one cruise goer said, at least Woodstock was free.
Ooh, burn.
Owned. Take that, Cunard Cruise Lines.
So how long did Cahotek's visible visit to the world last?
It was just a sort of blurry smudge in the night sky for a very short period of time. And most people who live near cities found that they could not see it anyway. You know, that people were shocked to discover that Long Island just had too much light pollution and they were never going to see even the little blur that was.
This was my experience as a kid, standing out with people pointing up at the sky and saying, see it, see it? And no one could see it.
I read an article from the time where a Harvard astronomer was asked about that, and he said, the problem may be that it never got as bright as it was supposed to. So there you go. Harvard's on it. They figured it all out.
Listen, when it comes time to have someone explain it to you, it ought to be a Harvard scientist.
I really do relate to this. You know, the idea that this hundreds of millions of people were so excited for this exciting, dawning thing, you know, and at a very tough time for a lot of people. You know, the optimism of the 60s had turned into Altamont, and the Beatles had broken up, and Vietnam and Watergate were only getting worse, you know, and finally something comes from the heavens and then it just sucks too.
It's a dud.
Time magazine quoted some onlooker as just saying Watergate, then the energy crisis, and now the comet, like just a trifecta of sucky 70s crap, you know, so it couldn't have come at a worse time for America. And I really relate to that kind of disappointment. Like, to me, that's always been one of the emotions that evokes the most pathos in me, is like small disappointment. Like, I'll watch a movie where somebody has cancer and I'll be like, oh, what a shame, you know?
Yeah.
But I'm emotionally incapable of watching a movie where somebody's date doesn't show up for dinner and the candles burn all the way down, or somebody goes to an airport and the person doesn't show and the scene ends with flowers in a garbage can. I can't even watch that. Like, it really hits something very deep in me.
It breaks your heart.
It is, and I'm not sure why.
Well, there's also that other thing in human beings where, and this is something I think a lot of people are sort of privately ashamed of, which is that when they hear about disasters, they secretly hope that it's worse than it ends up being. Like,
yeah,
every time there's a big earthquake, there's this desire, I think, that is fairly common for it to be the big one.
This little part of you is thinking, oh, I hope this is just some amazing spectacle.
And so much of our contemporary culture, which hopefully is not the case in the future, is based on apocalypse, including this very podcast. The idea that the future will be inhabited by mindless zombies, or that there will be a sort of day after scenario where the laws are making and upholding institutions are gone, and every single person is sort of in their lawless tribe.
Right.
And so the comet arriving, like all sort of big celestial events, it feels like maybe this is, the ancients were right. Maybe these are harbingers of destruction. Maybe this is the thing that will create like giant apes that go to war with humans.
This happened in the year 1000, by the way, and in the year 2000, you know.
Right.
People expected the end of the world either by computer virus or Jesus, you know, right. Pick your means.
Well, you think about the Hale-Bopp comet and how, it activated all these cults, including the one.
Sure. People are still killing themselves over a particular comet.
Yeah.
An accidental comet.
Accidental comet.
After all these musicians, you know, had immortalized the hope offered by Comet Cahotek, really the only band that was smart enough, because they didn't exist yet, was wise enough to hold off their take, was REM.
Hmm.
On their 1985 album, Fables of the Reconstruction.
Fully 10 to 12 years later.
Yes. They finally offered the definitive musical take on Cahotek. It might be my favorite REM record.
It's a great record.
Are you a murmur guy? Are you a document guy?
That whole era, I do not think there's a single bad note in all that REM. And partly it is the operating principle of the band was that each band member, when in the studio, would ask for their part to be turned down.
Right.
Unlike every other band in history.
Unlike Kraftwerk and Journey and Pink Floyd.
No, they would sit in the studio, and when the other guys were out of the room, they would lean forward and say to the producer, "Can you turn me down a little bit?" And that was the great era of REM, a completely selfless unity where every part was just sort of blended and indistinguishable from every other part.
But then Michael Stipe discovered consonants.
Oh my God. And somebody told him to turn his vocals up.
He took elocution lessons for 3 months.
The end.
And everything went to hell, as it often does. But before that, when he was just kind of mumbling, REM wrote their song Cohotec, which uses the disappointment of the fizzled comet as a symbol for a dead relationship. You know, two ships that passed in the night, didn't go anywhere. Stipe saying, and I think this is right, although I spent a lot of the 80s listening to this with my ear against the speakers, and I still don't know if the lyrics are right. She carried ribbons, she wore them out. Courage built a bridge, jealous tore it down. At least it's something you've left behind. Like Cohotec, you were gone.
And that concludes Cohotec, entry 692.JUO113, certificate number 31644, in the omnibus. In the unlikely event social media still exists in your era, futurelings, our tweets are archived at Omnibus Project. Our respective handles on Twitter were at Ken Jennings and at John Roderick. Please follow us both and comment on everything we say if you're a time traveler.
Or if Twitter still exists and has not been the mechanism that has actually ended the world, as seems increasingly likely in our time.
It could be both things. It could be Skynet.
Yes, if Twitter has become sentient, and in fact we are speaking to Twitter, please follow us.
Please follow us, Twitter. Please do not destroy our timelines. You can, in the future, if this is all true, go back and fave our tweets from thousands of years ago. That would be incredibly gratifying.
Maybe it would change history. Maybe it would make us the kings of Twitter in your era.
I'm kind of already the king of Twitter. A very small corner of Twitter. The coolest corner.
Cool Twitter? Is that your...
Cool Twitter.
Is that your niche?
Yeah, cool Twitter. I also maintained an Instagram account because I am very handsome and I like to take selfies.
Do you feel Instagram is cool Twitter?
Instagram was cool Twitter. And now there's uncool Instagram and cool Instagram.
Because all the normies came rushing in.
Yeah, they sure did. My Instagram account is also at John Roderick. If you have the technology to email us, wherever you are in time, please email at us, or at email us at omnibusproject@howstuffworks.com.
Future listeners, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our current civilization will survive. It's possible that ill harbingers of doom are approaching our skies even now.
Comets we haven't even seen yet.
We hope and pray that's not true, that the comets will stay in the Oort cloud for a little bit longer and the worst may never come. But if it does come sooner, this particular recording, like every other recording in this project, may be our final word to you. We hope that's not true. We hope that Providence will allow us to be with you again soon for another entry in the Omnibus.